You said at one point that if we pull through the danger of extinction, which we now face, we will find a better world than ever before. Why?
Oh, well, because then all science, which is now devoted to death and destruction, can be devoted to exactly the opposite. If the same amount of scientific ingenuity and scientific effort were devoted to improving the world, the world could in a very short time be completely transformed. Now, take a very simple thing, undernourishment. At present, two-thirds of the human race are undernourished. That is totally unnecessary with the money that we're now spending on armaments. We could cause them all to be perfectly nourished.
Lord Russell, when the Russians resumed nuclear testing after a three-year moratorium, you protested that resumption vigorously, and you wrote a letter to Mr. Khrushchev.
Yes.
He replied to you. Did he convince you?
He convinced me that he was a Russian, if that's what you mean. No, not a plea. I don't want to say that quite. I mean, I think all the politicians of the great powers are people who care more for their own power in the immediate present than they do for the future of mankind. And he persuaded me that he was like that. And I went to the embassy here and protested to them. I got inside the embassy. They let me come in and talk to them. And of course, they just shrugged their shoulders. You see, this is, you're infected by this American idea that I'm a communist.
Oh, no, sir, I am not. I protest mightily. I do not in any sense.
I mean, I'm quite as much against the Russians as against the Americans. I'm just against this system. And those in the system, whichever side they're on, I'm against.
I just want to make very clear to you, Lord Russell, that I do not believe that. I believe, in fact, that one of the greatnesses of the 20th century is the fact that you have lived in it. That's how I feel. I wanted to ask you, though, when America resumed nuclear testing recently, did you address a letter to President Kennedy?
I can't remember whether I addressed a letter personally to him. I think I'd rather exhausted that, writing a long letter to Eisenhower.
Oh, I see.
And but I joined in the protests. I mean, of course, I very much objected to Americans resuming tests, and I object still more to British people, especially Labour people, supporting the Americans in that.
I noticed that one of our scientists, Dr. Linus Pauling, a Nobel Prize winner, has estimated that with each test, some 15,000 people, I think he said, would die in the future because of genetic defects and mutations of their blood cells and one thing or another. Do you agree with that?
I agree with that. And this is generally accepted among scientists. You spoke in the earlier stage of this discussion about disagreements between scientists. The only disagreement is between scientists who are paid and scientists who are not paid.
By government.
Yes.
Now, the scientists who meet annually as a result of your having originated the conference, the Pugwash conference.
Yes.
They meet annually, nuclear scientists, from all over the world.
Yes.
Are they more alarmed, unanimously more alarmed, unanimously more terrified?
Yes, they had a congress in Vienna not long ago and drew up a report which they signed unanimously. Well, there was one American who had some reservations, but only one out of a very, very large number. And there were Russians who signed it and so forth and so on. And if you were to read that report, I think you would be astonished.
How do you view that crazy anomaly that the science has invented the death and are now in the forefront of protesting the invention?
Well, it was so due to horror of Hitler. I mean, scientists would never have worked to create the atom bomb, if it hadn't been that Hitler was really so appalling, and that we were all persuaded that Hitler must be getting very near an atom bomb of his own. It turned out that he wasn't, but we all had a great respect for the cleverness of German scientists, and we thought he must be, and he wasn't. But to defeat Hitler, people felt it was worthwhile. And I still think that, Hitler had to be defeated.
Albert Einstein, who is credited with being the father of the atomic bomb, or the equations which led to the atomic bomb,
yes,
at his death had joined your scientific movement,
yes,
to disarm nuclear weapons, hadn't he?
Yes, it was the last public act of his life, a day or two before his death, to agree to sign the declaration that I was issuing with about 12 very, very eminent men of science signing it.
Did he write anything to you? Did he say anything?
He just signed this draft which I'd done. He wrote and said he was too ill to do any more than that. He was dying, you see.
You knew Einstein?
Oh, yes, I knew him quite well.
What sort of a man was he? What is
he? Oh, he was a lovely man, Einstein. Oh, lovely man. He had the most perfect simplicity and perfect modesty. And all his feelings were humane. And, yes, I loved Einstein.
I think you once said, if I remember your quotation, that he was the most extraordinary great man you had ever known in your life.
Yes. Oh, he was a very, very great man. Oh, yes. Oh, you're wonderful, man.
Will you excuse me, Lord Russell? We have to pause again very briefly. Lord Russell, you are 90 years old, at an age when most men are docile and inactive. You seem to be at the crescendo of your effort and your energies and your dedication. Though you once said you'd been forced into being a rebel, it was quite against your temperament. Would you comment?
I don't think I was by nature a rebel at all. I was born into a comfortable station in life and was in youth surrounded with friends and had everything to make me cheerful. And although there were things in the world that I thought ought to be changed, it looked quite probable that they would be changed without too much effort. And in fact, a great many of them were. So that I was not rebellious. I didn't begin to be a rebel until the First War came. I thought the First War completely unnecessary. I knew that four members of the British cabinet had lied to the nation to bring it about, and had lied even to the cabinet. And I thought this was a scurvy sort of way to behave, and I protested all I could, and then I did become a rebel, but it was circumstances that forced me into it, not temperament.
Would you comment on this? Since I've been in London, Lord Russell, Lord Beaverbrook celebrated his 83rd birthday, and there was quite a party for him the other night, at which Sir Winston Churchill and others were present. Prime Minister Macmillan, at the party, said this, addressing Lord Beaverbrook and Sir Winston Churchill. He said, we all start as revolutionaries and finish up firm members of the establishment. That is the pattern of life.
Well, it's his pattern of life, but it's not my pattern of life. And all I can say is I'm not without predecessors. Take Wycliffe, for instance. Wycliffe didn't begin to be a rebel till he was 60. And he managed quite a good bit of rebellion after that.
Might the world be possibly a little better off if there were more rebels?
Yes, I suppose so. Well, I don't know, because if it were better off, there would be less need of rebellion.
I didn't think of that. Lord Russell, have you missed anything going through life without religion?
Well, I never missed religion. I mean, I was very religious as a boy. And between the ages of 15 and 18, I gradually decided that there was no evidence in favor of any of the religious dogmas. And I've been just as well without it. I've never missed it.
And as you get older, you feel no more need of it than you ever did previously?
Oh, no, none whatever. I mean, it's obvious that my age is not relevant in assessing the universe.
Your arguments are frequently unassailable. You've written a great deal about the relationship between men and women, and you commented at one point a year or so ago in the research I did that, in your opinion, men-women relationships are infinitely better today than they were when you were young.
Yes, I think so. I think so. There are some things to be said on the other side, but I don't think they're nearly as important. I think that a really close and intimate relation between two human beings ought to be founded on equality and mutual respect. And in the days before women were recognized as equals, they were not treated as equals in anything that required intelligence, and were treated as superiors in anything that required morals. And I thought both were quite absurd.
How has it improved the basic man-woman relationship?
Well, there's much more freedom, a great deal more freedom. A woman is not expected to obey her husband. Obeying, anyhow, is a bad business. You shouldn't obey. And then, of course, another thing that I think has improved marriage, though most people think the opposite, is the much greater possibility of divorce. When there was no possibility of divorce, there was no incentive for the husband to behave decently. And now I think there is.
Lord Russell, you've also said that to do great things, you must have enormous self-confidence. Do you mean about the rightness of your convictions, or do you mean about the chances of succeeding with your effort?
Oh, no, not the chances of succeeding. I think those you just have to leave to fate. You can't do anything about it. But I think one should have a certain confidence in one's own judgment of right and wrong. I certainly think so. And I mean, that, after all, is good Christian doctrine.
At another point, you said that Henry VIII, like one of your ancestors, which fact enabled you to pursue your interest in logic, philosophy, and mathematics? Would you otherwise not have been able to do so or have been circumscribed in some way?
Not so well. I mean, if I'd had to be earning my living all the time, I couldn't have given all my time to this work, which in fact I did. It was a great advantage. I mean, I collaborated with Whitehead. Whitehead had very little money except what he earned. And in order to earn his money, he had to work quite hard. So that a great deal of the manual work involved Philip and me, inevitably. And, writing the thing out for the press, one couldn't use a typewriter because it wasn't any sort of ordinary English. And there was a great deal of labor that I had to do that he couldn't do because he was busy. And if we'd both been busy, I don't know what would have happened.
You also said that you've always hated hypocrisy and cruelty. You've always hated hypocrisy and cruelty. And you continue to do so. Do you see more hypocrisy and cruelty about today than...
No. In a great many ways, there's less hypocrisy. and in a great many ways there's less cruelty. I think the hypocrisy nowadays is chiefly concentrated on public affairs. I mean, of course, every politician is a hypocrite. Otherwise, he'd be out of office because the public won't vote for a man unless he's a hypocrite, which I greatly regret.
Are you suggesting there are no good politicians anywhere, men of good will, men of intellectual caliber?
Oh, there are a few, yes, there are a few, but they're not, as a rule, very successful.
Well, it was Abraham Lincoln.
There have been some, of course. I mean, I admire Abraham Lincoln enormously. I think he's the politician I admire most of all there have ever been. But in general, you can't expect a politician to be quite an honest man. But I think there's much less hypocrisy in other ways. Now, I mean, before Shaw came along, people used to talk about a fate worse than death. Well, nobody talks about it now, and that's due to Shaw. And I think it's a great service he's done to mankind.
You once said of George Bernard Shaw that he was all vanity, nothing more. By means of wit, he concealed the fact that he was silly.
Well, I think that's too severe.
Too severe? You were in a severe mood that day. Do you think he made an important contribution, Shaw?
I don't think I should like to swear to that view now, no.
All right, let's throw that away. You also said great innovators must invariably suffer.
What?
Great innovators must suffer.
Yes, so innovators always suffer. At least, not of course if they're purely technical. I don't think Edison suffered. But if they're not purely technical, they arouse hostility because each generation wants to think that it's perfect. And an innovator suggests that it might conceivably be improved, and that's insulting. So that innovators are unpopular.
What about your statement, a poet can still be an individual, but most people can't?
Well, there I was thinking in terms of economics. Nowadays, most people have to earn a living, and most people earn their living by being part of some very large organization, some large business organization or the civil service or something like that, where your individuality has very little chance. But of course, a literary man is in a peculiarly fortunate position. He can write what he likes. He doesn't have to accept dictation. And he's freer than almost any other man who has to earn his living.
The rest have to adhere. The rest have to go along get by. Is that the...
No, and in fact, a great many literary men have made a very good living out of expressing unpopular opinions.
Mm-hmm. You've also commented that you thought that liberty is almost bound to be less in our time than it was in the 19th century.
Yes, well, that has to do with large organizations. Organizations were not so large then, nor were they so universal. And therefore there was much more room for the individual than there is now. I think that's an inevitable effect of industrialism. I don't think it can be helped except by some very elaborate system of liberalizing industrialism, but that would be quite a difficult job.
In our own country, the United States, we see civil liberties being circumscribed out of fear.
Yes.
As we suspect that the communists might overwhelm us or sabotage us from within, many of our citizens will go along with a curtailment of civil liberties.
Yes.
Out of fear. Would you comment on that?
Yes, I certainly would comment on that. I mean, I found that all the people who most loudly proclaim that we must fight communism in the name of liberty also most loudly proclaim that we mustn't have any liberty at all, that liberty is very dangerous, and that people, for instance, who appeal to the First or Fifth Amendment are not to be tolerated. Although they will always applaud Patrick Henry saying liberty or death, and will never mention that he was the author of the First and Fifth Amendments.
Your observation is very accurate. We pause again, Lord Russell, for just a brief moment.